Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Berso Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF out of Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP out of Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found at thefinalstrawradio.noblog.org. You can podcast the show from radioforall.net. This week's episode of The Final Straw features a segment by Sean Swain, followed by a special guest appearance by Anarchistisches Radio Berlin, which is an interview with a comrade from Sao Paulo involved in the Comité Popular da Copa, a coordination group and a bunch of individuals against the FIFA World Cup and its negative effects. This interview was recorded, and they hope to have a follow-up interview about the anti-FIFA struggle currently. The interview goes into different topics, including the historical context of the Brazilian situation, the social protests since 2013, and obviously the World Cup. Thanks to those folks for sharing this information. More audio from Anarchistisches Radio Berlin can be found at aradio.blogsport.de. The final portion of the show, about 40 minutes in, is the first part of an interview with anarcho-primitivist author Leila Abdelrahim on her book Wild Children, Domesticated Dreams, Civilization, and the Birth of Education. Wild Children was published last year by Fernwood. More information on the book can be found at fernwoodpublishing.ca. The remaining 1 hour of the conversation will be featured on our next episode of The Final Straw. Enjoy. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? Oh, come like a boss! State House. When I first arrived here at the super-duper uber-mega Ultramax, we could watch the Ohio Channel. It was a PBS station that broadcast the legislative sessions of the Ohio General Assembly and the hearings of the Ohio Supreme Court. It's probably not as much fun as monkeys at the zoo when you throw peanuts to them, but you can't really expect the Ohio government to compete with monkeys.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional institution and may be recorded or monitored.
A documentary that was aired on the Ohio Channel presented the history of the Ohio State House and how it was constructed. According to the documentary, construction was started, halted, and restarted several times. Finally, it was constructed by prisoners who were used as slave labor. In one of the more interesting interviews, one historian described how, when the state required prisoners with certain experience, like bricklaying or carpentry or other professions, citizens with that needed experience and know-how would get arrested, prosecuted, and imprisoned for crimes at an inordinate rate. The historians who discussed this thought it humorous and chuckled at the idea that government officials used the justice system to harvest free labor for purposes of building the state house. It was funny that Ohio citizens were railroaded and their lives were ruined so the government could save money building its capital. They also revealed that some workers died in the construction of the state house. They were, after all, prisoners, and that meant they were slaves. So they worked at longer hours in substandard conditions, and safety didn't matter. So sometimes prisoners slipped and fell to their death. Since it was amusing that innocent people got shafted in the courts and sent to prison to fulfill the construction needs of the state, wouldn't it be knee-slapping, pee-your-pants hilarious if some of those innocent people ended up plummeting to their death during the building of the state house? Yeah. It doesn't get any funnier than a tyrannical state enslaving and killing its citizens, does it? Just in case I'm unclear, such a documented history of the Ohio State House construction points to a universal truth. Mind over matter. The state doesn't mind, you don't matter. The state of Ohio has a constitution describing a laundry list of rights that all Ohioans have. That constitution was written by a guy named Thomas Worthington and his pals, who violated a U.S. treaty to steal land from the people who owned it so they could declare the sacred rights of those who stole it. I describe in detail that whole illegitimate process in a series of zines called Ohio. They're posted on the site. But what value is a constitution and declared rights when you've got a state that reserves the right to enslave you on a whim and hijack your life? All those so-called rights are just random marks on paper when the state decides its interests outweigh yours. All those rights and rules and laws are just fiction when the state decides it wants something. And if it's fiction some of the time, that means it's always fiction all the time for all of us. The state doesn't mind. You don't matter. That's probably the reason the state of Ohio includes so many lofty ideas in its constitution. It knows it will never be compelled to live up to them. For instance, not that it matters, but Article 1, Section 2 of the Ohio Constitution says we have the right to abolish the government. Consider that. Abolishing government isn't asking it to leave or petitioning it to leave. Abolishing the government implies telling it to leave, making it leave. And that implies force, violence. We know that it must because no government would peacefully accept eviction, especially one that has a history of employing its troops to gun down its critics, like Ohio did at Kent State. So that means the Ohio Constitution, not that it matters, invites the people of Ohio to use violence and overthrow the government whenever they may deem it necessary. I don't know, but that sounds like an invitation written by those who know they'll never have to worry about it. An invitation written by a government that has Apache attack helicopters and isn't afraid to use them. A government that assumes to recognize rights and break them at will. By the way, rights are never given. They are always taken. The Thomas Worthingtons who write constitutions count on you not taking them. The oppressors who enslave you to construct their government buildings count on you not taking them. The Ohio State House still stands, centuries after Ohio prison slaves built it. Isn't that a tragedy? This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Ohio Supermax Facility. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain number 243-205 OSP 878 Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org.
Sagen Sie jetzt mal bitte
Anarchie.
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 Ob geschichtlich oder brandaktuell?
Mit Berichten und Interviews, mit Beiträgen und Collagen
beleuchtet das anarchistische Radio Berlin das Phänomen des Anarchismus.
Viva Anarchie!
Bienvenido.
Welcome.
Gracias.
Thanks.
In this interview, we will talk about various topics, among them the social protests and, of course, the Football World Cup. Before we begin, however, it would be nice if you could introduce yourself. Where are you from, and in what were you involved with the social struggles in Brazil?
My name is Danilo. I live in Sao Paulo, and I have a lectureship in geography. I've been active in anarchist circles in Sao Paulo for a long time already and take part in various groups. Currently, I'm also taking part in an anarchist center, a so-called Ateneo, with the name Casa Mafalda. This center is also part of the coordination of social movements, groups, and individuals who fight against the human rights violations that are taking place here in the lead-up to the World Cup. This coordination calls itself the Comité Popular de la Copa. In every urban site of the World Cup, there is such a Comité Popular de la Copa. Then there is a nationwide networking of all these committees. People from groups that are active in support of rights of very different kinds all come together in this committee. For living space, for the rights of street merchants, against networks of child prostitution, against the way that the police are organized in Brazil. These are groups that have worked on these topics for a longer time in the city than that now. On the occasion of the World Cup, have joined together, since the World Cup exacerbates those problems even further.
I think that we'll talk more concretely about this topic a bit later. I think, though, that for an understanding of the current situation in Brazil, it will be necessary to have a bit more of a social and political context, and specifically to know something about what happened in the last years under the government of Dilma Rousseff. So, what happened? How has the country developed in the past years?
¿Cómo se ha desarrollado el país, digamos?
Bueno, creo que no es posible hablar del gobierno de ahora, de Dilma, sin hablar de los gobiernos que pasaron antes, ¿no?
I don't think it's possible to talk about the current government of Dilma without talking about previous governments. Since Portugal founded, or invented really, Brazil, the same circle of people have always been in power. These people stayed in power until 2002, when for the first time a president was elected who had a working class background. His party, the Workers' Party, PT, emerged in the 80s in the time of the dictatorship. The struggle of the party, which at the time was communist, with a basically Trotskyist tendency, was directed against the dictatorship. In the time between the 1980s and 2002, however, the PT, in the context of the political electoral theater, has again and again made partnerships with right-wing and moderate parties, so that today they can better be described as a social democratic or moderate leftist party than as a leftist party. What happened since 2002 in Brazil with this party in government can be characterized as at least the beginnings of a welfare state. The poorest received money from the government. At the same time, the government put a lot of money into the economic and infrastructural development of the region so that they could attract foreign investments. The government also succeeded at diversifying the economy, which was previously very tightly bound to the US dollar. Now the domestic economy has broadened and has had transactions with the euro, the Chinese yen or Japanese yen, so a bit of everything. In this way, the country became more economically stable. So when things then went downhill in the USA, the country wasn't pulled down with it in the same way. In order to succeed in government, this party put a lot of emphasis on social movements. As they finally succeeded at making it into the government, they tried to integrate all the leading persons of these movements into the government. The result was, of course, a pacification of class antagonisms. The social movements from below were represented in government and thereby reached success, even if it was only small. Meanwhile, the upper class amassed more money. The banks, the construction companies, the oil companies, they all continued to make huge profits. The situation was a classic social democratic government in a poor country. Years went by, and this government, which everybody thought would be different than the others since it came out of the working class, just continued doing the same ish as the previous government. There was corruption, a lot of corruption scandals. They put more money into the development of the country in the capitalist sense than they put into a real reform of the social structure of the country, like an agrarian reform, an urban reform, a reform of communication media. Nothing like that happened. There was just this offer of bonuses and small financial support. In this situation, a new generation of younger people grew up for whom this Workers' Party stood for everything that was wrong with the world, since the media, of course, depicted it that way. Those guys are communists, they're friends with Cuba, they're corrupt, they're thieves, as if the previous government hadn't just done just the same-ish. So we have youth who don't like this party at all, and an older group who don't like any party anymore, since they didn't like the right anyway, and the left, which once seemed alternative, had also done a bunch of garbage in the 12 years it was in power. In 2013, it then looked like the economy wouldn't continue doing so well anymore. Because in capitalism, it is the case that all economies that go up at some point go down again. The lower middle class, which had a little bit more money available to it, could buy more stuff and had access to the consumer market, already started to have difficulties in a situation that just a few years before had seemed to be a paradise for them. The same thing happened in the middle class. Many were dissatisfied, since the spaces which they used to have privileged access to, like airports, shopping malls, spaces in which the middle class went into and out of, while the poor remained shut out. They now had to share these spaces with the poorer classes. In general, a great social discontent emerged, and in all the poorer classes, there were, apart from the bonuses, no changes. They are still very poor. For example, the living problem created by this government is a problem which is connected to private property. We are now in the process of handing over private property to people who have never had fixed employment, so they are in no position to pay off the debts of getting their own apartment. Unlike the favelas in the new apartments created by the government, there is also taxes, water, electricity to take into account. So these people leave the apartments the government gave them and sell them to other people who take on the debt, people from the middle class who are a bit less poor. Then they go back to another favela. So the government doesn't solve the basic social problems in Brazil, a government that has only a history of leftism, since its practices are the same as those of a right or social democratic government. So for this reason, the government has met with resistance. This, of course, both from the right, which rejects its workers' background, and also from the middle class, since they are not neoliberal but social democratic, but also from the left, since they are not just leftist. So for the first time in a while, there is a climate in Brazil, a perspective for the self-organization of social movements. Collectives and groups that used to be very small, or practices that weren't widely spread before, like self-defense, the occupation of spaces, or horizontal organizing, now have another position in the social movements and among the population. This became obvious in 2013, when the Movement for the Free Transportation, who had already organized protests against the high transportation costs and campaigned for free local public transportation, basically for the right to the city for all the population, began protests against the annual fare increase. This time, a lot of people came together. The strong police repression finally led to a people's insurrection breaking out, which then also encompassed other topics, the World Cup, education, etc., and whose spirit is still alive. In some places more, in others less. It seems as if the working class, the middle class, and the general population have suddenly recognized what the poor had already known for a long time. That is, that small victories and achievements are fought for on the street. It is not the case that there have never been social struggles in Brazil. There were always struggles from the poor and the invisible. Now this struggle is visible. There were societal classes which the government supported, which, however, were slowly alienated by the government, since the government didn't change anything. There were just minimal changes on very specific points, but at no point was there a reform, let alone something that had revolutionary character. I think that that is basically the social context of Brazil today.
Ya mencionabas los levantamientos de 2013. Por acá se ve.
You've already told us about the social insurrections in 2013. The situation in Brazil was explained here in Europe, also in the context of the insurrections in the Mediterranean. For example, in Brazil, there seemed to have been the claim, the bus prices are our Taksim Square. Do you see a connection in this sense? Maybe a general global development that is also manifesting itself in Brazil?
No sé, un desarrollo más general mundial que también se sigue en Brasil.
Sí, claro. A mí me parece que hay hoy en el mundo un gran conflicto entre gobernados y gobernantes.
Definitely. To me, it seems that today there is a large conflict between the governed and those who govern. The population doesn't seem to want to be governed anymore in the way that they currently are. And although there is a discontent over being ruled, it is clear that this isn't linked to a political perspective. If we look at the indignados in Spain, or Occupy in New York, or even these protests in Brazil, or what happened in Taksim Square, people know that they don't want to be ruled in this way. They are fed up with representative democracy, but there is not a political perspective. There is just this immense discontent with the existing model of representative democracy. In this sense, the protests have a lot to do with what happened in Taksim Square and in other places on this planet. We could also look at the movement from the other direction, though. When cities in Germany, Austria, or Switzerland decided against hosting the Olympic Summer or Winter Games, then it seems to me totally clear to be only the mirror image of what happens in Brazil. The whole world can see that the country of football is vehemently opposed to football. Obviously not against football as such, but against FIFA, against a government, which is hosting a tournament in which a mega corporation can just do what it wants with the country, which of course hurts the workers and the poor. So it seems to me that the fact that these countries in Europe say no to these mega events directly reflects what happened in Brazil and what happened. I think that there's a discontent. When we look back and consider how everything has developed, with the Zapatista insurrection of 1994, Seattle 1999, Argentina 2001, now that we have social networks and the world in general is more networked, this information reaches other places much more quickly, so that insurrections take place temporarily very close to one another. Before, years lay in between the individual countries, even though they were in a relationship with each other. Today, everything happens almost simultaneously. So the thought today is, in which country is it happening next? And of course, in many places, there are social insurrections that we don't hear anything about in Brazil. Just a little while ago, for example, I saw a video on the situation in Bosnia-Herzegovina. What's happening in the Ukraine, of course, makes it onto the TVs because it's huge. However, what happened in Iceland, where there was seemingly also a larger social insurrection with public gatherers, etc., was not talked about in Brazil at all. In Colombia, there was a presidential election a few days ago, I think, and 49% of the population abstained from voting. This discontent with representative democracy can be recognized everywhere, but I fear that there is a lack of a political project which will take its place. Of course, there are small groups that have such ideas as and struggle for them. I think in Greece you can see an organized example of this. But I think there is a tendency of, I am dissatisfied, I want something different, but I don't know what.
Bueno, tú mencionabas algunos temas de las protestas como el precio del transporte público o el tema de la corrupción.
You explained some of the topics of the protests, such as the bus fare increases or the topic of corruption, and you said that you don't think that people have a clear political perspective. What are the other topics of the protests? What are people doing, for example, in connection with police violence and the militarization of cities? Are those also important topics of protest?
La militarización de las ciudades, eso es un tema importante también para las protestas.
Bueno, cronológicamente lo que podemos decir es que pasó primero la protesta por la...
Chronologically speaking, you could say that the protests against fare increases were at the beginning. There was a strong repression from the side of the police against these protests after the media, which is controlled from the right powers, quasi-collectively called for the police trying to create an end to the protests. The larger media basically led a campaign to get the police to end the protests. Afterward, they decided to go over to the side of supporting the protests and depicted them as if it were youth who were going onto the street for a better country and against corruption. This was a method of attacking the government of the Workers' Party. This corruption scandal got the same sort of attention as if it were the only case in Brazilian history. On June 17, 2013, there were large demos with 200,000 people in Sao Paulo, a 500,000 in Rio. And there were a large diversity of topics, many of them introduced by the media, against corruption, for a return of the military to power and other crap of that kind. And there was an immense number of Brazil flags. Because the people who were protesting, mostly the middle classes, had previously never gone onto the streets, so this was a first time for them. I think in such cases it is very common, also in the protests in Turkey, a lot of Turkish flags were brought out. In Argentina 2001, there were Argentinian flags. It is a little bit of the expression of the population that I am taking my country back. In Brazil, there were, however, a lot of themes introduced by the right and the middle class. The slogan against corruption can, for example, be extremely easily appropriated, since who would openly support corruption? Nobody. The claim that this was a movement against corruption says exactly as much as if it were a movement for water. Of course, everybody is for water. In this way, the right can easily appropriate this topic. There was an internal split within the protest. The left supported social demands for housing, transport, against the militarization of the police and the police violence. The right was rather for the topics being pushed by the media, like the rejection of corruption, for a better country, or for the removal of the president. Many people also called for restoring the military to power. After the protests against the fare increases came, the protests against the Confederations Cup, in Sao Paulo, we had no games in the Confed Cup. But where there were some, this spirit of public revolt remained alive. Huge protests happened where the question was posed of why FIFA can make such a big profit while the population doesn't have good hospitals and doesn't have homes and, in addition to that, have to pay higher fares for their transport. In this way, a questioning of FIFA and the Football World Cup began. In Rio, the protests were continued by teachers who had already been on strike for a while. Then the Black Bloc showed up too. The Black Bloc then became a big topic, and everywhere people were asking, who are these people? What do they want? They want to destroy everything, and so on. In this way, there was an attempt to make the Black Bloc into the bad guys of the demos and the other people into the good. The media, in this way, tried to introduce a division into the demonstrations, and they partially also succeeded at this. Not completely, but definitely partly. This year, it continued with the protests of the street sweepers. They organized a huge strike in Rio during the carnival, which created a big spectacle. Since then, all the streets during the carnival were full of garbage and the people were on strike. A month ago, there were then strikers in the transport sector, among them by the drivers of buses, the metro, and trains. Immediately following that, there was a strike by teachers and in other sectors. So for that reason, I have the impression that the World Cup stirred up a lot of struggles. especially those on the left, which had, to a certain extent, found themselves put on hold, or to say it better, which were invisible. The struggles were there on the periphery, but it all seemed far away. Now everything is in the open. Everyone can see that the World Cup is making the situation worse for all these people who are already living under difficult conditions. Also with the topic of the police, it's the case that for the first time, there were loud and clear demands for a demilitarization of the police. In Brazil, the police is the same police force that was active in the time of the military dictatorship. And the police officers have military training. That means they were trained for war. Now they are constantly in contract with the population, more or less at war against the population. Because when you train the police to be at war with the population, war is what comes out of that. In the Brazilian periphery, the number of youths, especially black youths, who die at the hands of the police is extremely high. Since that June, however, the demilitarization of the police has been demanded very loudly. There is also a proposition about that right now. I have the impression that the discursive political field in Brazil has been opened wider than ever before in history, even wider than it was before the dictatorship. The people are now on the streets, but with the consciousness that their successes depend on their presence in the streets, on the pressure they create, because voting is not going to make anything new happen. There are an unbelievable number of people on the streets who, for example, had never heard the word anarchism before in their lives, but who came to us during the demos and said, "We have to bring this city to a standstill on election day. Nobody should go voting. We can't rely on voting anymore." Because a recognition has arisen that the act of voting constitutes a legitimation and that by participating in voting, we become complicit in this legitimation. So for that reason, we see a great discontent among the population on all of these topics. Truthfully, I also don't know what will happen. Because on the other side, the state just keeps on dishing out more repression. The forces of repression have at their disposal new weapons, new munitions, and more officers, who in part were trained by the Israeli army and police. So for that reason, it's unclear how these protests will continue. There are already a lot of people who, without having done anything, were arrested and basically taken into preventative detention, and it's possible that this will also happen in Sao Paulo. We also don't know what will happen in terms of repression, but we're going to stay on the streets. I think that if the World Cup will have a positive effect, then it's this change in perspective among the population that struggle should be taken to the street, and that collectively we have a lot more power than we do if we just struggle alone. So we hope that struggles will continue after the World Cup and with a lot of energy.
Still, it would interest me what the feeling among the broader population about the World Cup is. Is there, or can you observe, this euphoria, which in my opinion always gets spread in the context of these kind of sport mega events? How many people are there who really reject the World Cup?
¿Cuánta gente realmente rechaza la Copa?
La última pesquisa que hizo la media tenía como 48% de la gente.
In the last survey that was done by the media, 48% of people supported the World Cup, 52% rejected it. So it's basically half-half. In Brazil, for example, it's common to paint the streets with the national colors and hang out flags during these kinds of tournaments. And that's not happening now. There are streets that are painted and have flags, but there are a lot less of them than is normally the case. This morning, I was invited to a presentation about the comité at a public school in the northern periphery of the city. And I asked the students there if their streets were painted or not. About half said yes, the other half no. Why is that? I think that many people are very dissatisfied with the World Cup. The World Cup is here, but nobody is allowed anything. Nobody from the poor population will go to the stadium because they don't have the money for the entrance. The street vendors can't work. The games can't even be watched in the bars on TV because FIFA trademarked a bunch of terms, World Cup 2014, World Cup Brazil 2014, pagode, a Brazilian style of music. They trademarked a bunch of things that are Brazilian. So the people aren't just prevented from going to the stadium, they are also prevented from celebrating in their neighborhoods with their own words. The discontent is high. When Brazil was chosen as the host of the World Cup in 2007, a lot of people thought that the World Cup would bring the people a lot of good things. Now they know that the opposite is true. All that the World Cup brings to the poor is the worsening of their situation. Those who profit from the World Cup are the rich, FIFA, the sponsors, the construction companies. You can sense an aversion to the World Cup in the population. I think, however, that when the World Cup begins, many people will follow the games and hope that Brazil will win. But a lot of people will also go into the streets. When the finale of the CONFED Cup in 2013 was hosted in Maracanã Stadium, there were more people protesting in front of the stadium than there were inside watching the game. That is a shock for Brazilian circumstances. Just crazy. Because, of course, here everyone is thinking, hey, it's about football. Everyone loves football. There's doubt this whole crap of modern football, even among the poorer people who, for example, like to bet on football games. There is a general discontent with the World Cup. What will happen? With all these struggles and strikes on the street, I don't know how the population will react. For example, the metro workers will go on strike on June 5th, a week before the World Cup, and they are playing with the idea of allowing the whole population to take the metro for free. If they really do that, they will get a huge support from the population. Imagine, for a whole day, there's free public transportation in a city like Sao Paulo with 11 million inhabitants. So if they do it, the support for their struggle will rise massively. Similarly, there was already enormous support for the street sweepers, who struggled for higher wages and better working conditions. Not even the middle class rejected their struggle. They applauded them and said they were right. That is a new phenomenon in Brazil. That the middle class supports the working class is something totally new in Brazil. Of course, we don't know how far that extends.
So you think we can really expect protests on a larger scale during the World Cup?
I think so. Right now, for example, there is this tour of the World Cup trophy. FIFA displays the cup for about 2 to 3 days in every hosting city, and at each of these places, until now, there were protests. To get a concrete impression, the trophy was in Brasilia for the first time yesterday, and many indigenous people, people from the homeless movement, teachers, etc., came out. There were altercations and many injured protesters, but a police person was also injured. An indigenous person shot him in the leg with an arrow. It seems like an image from the Middle Ages, but that's just what is happening now. That is the level of discontent at the moment. And of course, that isn't just related to the tour of the World Cup trophy. Of course, we know that the World Cup will mean a huge amount of security forces, so I assume there will be big protests that, however, won't succeed at making it close to the stadium.
Do you think that the police would allow themselves, in front of a gathering of cameras from all over the world, to go ahead and use massive violence against people?
That's a question that we, of course, also asked ourselves. That's the reason why, for us, contact to the international media is very, very important, so that they know what is happening here and that reports are published about it. I think that a lot of violence can happen outside of the view of cameras. If it will also happen in front of them, I'm not sure. If we look, for example, at how things were in South Africa, there was a young person who was sentenced to 7 years in prison for stealing a cell phone. Another person was sentenced to 4 years because of the theft of a watch or a digital camera. I can't remember anymore exactly. That happened far away from the cameras. Nobody cared about these cases. And things like that are happening constantly in Brazil. We don't need the World Cup for that. There are deaths, there are imprisonments, and nobody would ever know about them since there are no cameras where this happens. I think, though, that the presence of the entire international media will lead to the police taking more caution and maybe using less violent measures of repression. In Brazil, rubber bullets are still used, as well as tear gas and pepper spray and other things that are termed to be non-lethal weapons. We call them, rather, less lethal weapons. There was, for example, the case of an older woman who died in 2003 while she had breathed in too much tear gas and then suffered cardiac arrest in the hospital and died. So they are not non-lethal weapons. At best, they are less lethal weapons. A rubber bullet that hits you in the eye can still kill you. The police are constantly announcing that they have new equipment, like, for example, sound weapons that make people faint and have seizures, new water cannons, etc. It seems like they have imported a lot of expensive new techniques from Europe that have less severe effects, but that are very effective in their application, for example, in breaking up blockades. In the end, I have no doubt that real bullets will be fired side by side with the rubber ones. That already happened in 2013. Not all the media were there, but it happened. In 2014, it's also already happened, on January 25th, 2014, when during a protest in Sao Paulo, a guy was shot down with two bullets in his chest. He didn't die, but he spent a long time in the hospital.
Okay,
to bring the interview to an end, I would like to talk a bit more about FIFA. On the banners during the demonstrations, there was often written, FIFA go home, or something like that. What is the role of FIFA in the current context?
FIFA también en un momento.
Bueno, la FIFA es una mega corporación, ¿no?
FIFA is a mega corporation, right? An NGO, who did an internet survey a little while ago to vote for the worst corporation in the world, had the following results. In the first place was Gazprom. In second place, the chemical corporation Syngenta. And in third place was FIFA. If we only look at the votes from Brazil, then FIFA would be in first place, with a lead of 20,000 votes. So people know that FIFA is just a company here to do business, and the people definitely don't just blame FIFA. The critique isn't just of FIFA, but also the government. FIFA didn't pull one over the government. The government accepted their offer. So the protests are against both FIFA and the government. Against FIFA because of their model of sporting mega events which are elitist, are aimed at the rich, making the situation of the poor even worse, and which force the population to accept a lot of commercial and political rules that would seem bizarre to anybody on earth. Because basically they are making a profit out of the misery of Brazil. During the construction of the stadium, a total of 9 workers died, and because FIFA is so caught up in their crap, they would never come to the idea of canceling an event because of 9 deaths. For me, 9 deaths are more important than any event in the world. But of course, we know that capitalism doesn't work that way. The protests are against the government because they went along with it all, because they handed over the country to FIFA without, for example, raising taxes at all. What became very clear in looking at this event was that those who profit from it and those who have a very close relationship to the government are the construction companies. These people made a killing with the construction of stadiums, streets, etc., not just in Brazil, but in all of South America, because Brazil is a small empire. It's completely obvious that no matter which party is in power, they will represent the interests of the construction sector and the banks. The critique of FIFA is a critique of a mega corporation that doesn't care about human rights at all and is fully aware that its World Cup concert leads to human rights abuses. Their spokespersons, for example, give statements in which they say that Brazil has an excess of democracy, so that it would be more sensible to have the World Cup in countries with less democracy, like Russia. Jerome Valque said that. I think that these people are aware of the role that FIFA has. I believe, though, that the critiques are much more strongly directed against the government than against FIFA. This also seems to make sense to me, and not because I like FIFA. It seems to me more important that the government is accepting what FIFA is bringing in.
No que me guste la FIFA, pero me parece acertado sí. Que se comprenda que el gobierno acepta lo que está imponiendo FIFA.
Definitivamente. Muchas gracias.
Definitely. Thanks very much for the interview. We are definitely assuming that there will be considerable struggles being fought out in the coming weeks. We wish you guys, and especially the committee, all the best.
Muchos deseos para allá, sobre todo también para el comité.
Gracias. Yo te digo que...
Thanks. I can tell you already that it's very likely that we'll have a lot of arrests. So we've been preparing a solidarity campaign for a long time, in which we call for comrades from all over the world to organize solidarity events to financially support the release of the arrestees. There are already arrestees, actually, but there will be a lot more. Finally, I would also like to say that the international website of the Comité Populares is portopopulardacopa.org. On this website, you'll find a lot of articles as well as texts on what we think and do. Many of them are translated into Spanish, English, French, and German. So whoever is looking for more information will maybe find something on this site. You'll also find links there to the Comité in all the cities together with the contact information that you can just write to them. And we thank you guys for giving us the space that your radio provides. We also wish you a lot of strength. As a football fan, I'd also like to say that here we are very inspired by the ultras in Germany, the anti-fascist football fans in Germany, fans that struggle against modern football. It seems to us that the World Cup 2006 created some starting points for football fans beyond politics and on the questions of whether they were anarchists or not. They fought the fight for the right of a certain class. What else is there to say? Keep watching Brazil, because some pretty ugly things are probably going to happen here, and we will urgently need international support.
Nosotros definitivamente le vamos a dar difusión a eso.
We will definitely try to spread this information.
Good.
Bueno, ahí quedamos. Muchas gracias.
Okay, then we'll leave it at that. Thanks a lot.
Ciao.
E aqui de assaltar um banco, trocar com os polícia, ser número um ter fuzil, quadrada com mira. Acreditei que vendo escorrendo o sangue do rico, teria felicidade comigo, motivo pra um sorriso. Sempre rindo dos truta que tava trampando, desacreditando dos moleque estudando. Na quadra 13 anos, cocaína baseado. Hoje vivo por milagre, a um passo do fracasso. Sem profissão, sem emprego, frustrado. Entre a R15 e uma porra de salário. Filho da puta, estuda, escuta o professor.
We're speaking with Leila Abdel-Rahim. Leila is an anthropologist, researcher, and public speaker living in Montreal, Quebec. She's also a parent, anarcho-primitivist, and author of several books, most recently Wild Children, Domesticated Dreams, Civilization and the Birth of Education, out from Fernwood Publishing. Info on the book can be found at the publisher's website, fernwoodpublishing.ca. Thanks a lot for coming on, Leila.
Well, thank you for having me.
In reading your book, Wild Children, Domesticated Dreams, I really appreciated your inclusion of journal entries and observations as kickstarters to chapters and arguments, many of these centering around your daughter. Is it Luba?
Luba.
Luba,
yes.
Okay. As she grew up and developed. Can you talk about the impetus for writing this book and how it relates to your own experience of parenting?
Well, the book itself, like, as you know, the 130 pages, is kind of a side effect of my research, my life experiences, and my work, but also my experiences, particularly as a graduate student, while parenting, and having decided, even before I had my child, that if I ever am to have a child, I would never put that child to school. So it's a lot of reflections, actually, about civilization. Mostly, I would say, like, specifically, I worked in social and medical anthropology in Sweden as a researcher, looking at different conceptions of illness and health as bodies that are viewed by the social culture around them in terms of what roles do they play in that society. So particularly in Sweden, I was comparing the Somalis, the Somali concepts of illness and health and their attitudes or relationship to Swedish social workers and Swedish concepts of illness and health. And then inadvertently, obviously, at the time I was not conscious, but the question of childhood and how children get domesticated within that normalcy of healthy being a functioning human resource, and ill is someone who is deviant in a way. Deviant in the sense that either there's an illness that prevents that person from participating in the socioeconomic structure as a human, as laborer, as a human resource, or otherwise, you know, not being able to fulfill the roles to which that society subscribed. And so for Somalis, those concepts were not related to their functionability in the Swedish socioeconomic structure. And the question of children, who has the right to domesticate and to use the children, to integrate them as future human resources, was a constant sharp edge between these two communities. And so I left Sweden in 1998, and basically my child, so I went back to Russia, and my child was born a year after, so in March 99. So obviously that research was very fresh. And so exploring my own relationship to that child and having a child in a Russia that has not defined its post-Soviet trajectory yet. There was a lot of anarchist groups or different groups that did not even call themselves anything, especially in terms of parenting. Our friends had, you know, a movement, for example, you know, the Going Back to the Sea, inspired by Tchaikovsky, but not following like everything that Tchaikovsky prescribed. So it was very interesting. So kind of traveling and, you know, exploring the world with our children in that respect was very interesting to compare with my previous Swedish experience. And so I guess the ideas were parallel to my research. So when I came to Canada and started my PhD program, a few courses that I took, there was constantly that issue of what am I going to write, what is being expected. And so I felt that normalizing narrative of me as a healthy kind of student, as a participating student in the production of the knowledge that is sponsored by the state, not articulated clearly like that, but in the comments and the expectations of the professors from my work, it was very obvious. So in a way, it was my first essay in the book on objects, love, and objectifications came as an exploration of how that space is being structured. And the second on modernism and education was a response to a professor's really like adamant attempt to integrate me and domesticate me into her way of seeing what it is that students are to produce, or how are they to participate in that production of knowledge as healthy academics. And obviously I wasn't. So in a way, so that was in 2002. Those chapters came, and then they went all around. I put them on the internet, and then the book finally kind of just materialized itself in a couple of weeks in 2011.
Well, very much enjoyed reading through it. It's really complex and jam-packed with ideas. For the sake of the listening audience, would you mind, who may not be familiar with Critiques of Civilization and Domestication, can you talk really briefly about when you refer to civilization, what do you mean? And when you refer to domestication, what do you mean?
Okay, so for me, civilization is actually the material outcome of the sum of the relationships and decisions or say strategies for subsistence that a community or a society chooses. So civilization in this respect is not, as in the mainstream usually is taken to be, like human advancement. To me, any group, any species, or any group within any species, because not even like the whole of human species have chosen civilization. So there would be, for example, some ants would choose civilized relationships, others wouldn't, right? So what characterizes those strategies for subsistence? Basically, if we look at wilderness, in the wilderness, there's diversity, there's the constant movement towards innovation, towards tuning to how the world lives, how the world changes, so that every individual and every species can do their best to support that diversity and to live, because to live implies that you need that diversity. You cannot just live as a single species in an environment that is has nothing else but yourself, right? So there's a lot of intricacies involved in decisions, in tuning in and understanding intelligence. So when we look at civilized relationships, it's usually a group or a species that favors itself above everything else at the expense of diversity. So usually imposes a kind of monocultural perspective, and monoculturally identified interests. So for that group. So you can say viruses that take over an organism usually favor that monoculturalism at the expense of the environment in which they reproduce until that environment, if the environment cannot contain that outburst, that epidemic, the environment dies, right? So the organism collapses with cancer, with viruses, with bacteria that is overwhelming. Mostly bacteria, though, keep a balance of diversity and life in a symbiotic manner. So they reciprocate. And the same with human civilizations. This is what we're witnessing right now. The result of that monocultural decision to value human species and to value ownership within that species, which already stratifies even human species in terms of who is the resource and who is the owner of the resource. It creates this imbalance and this monocultural perspective that is not viable. And the result is a civilized reality. Domestication is the method of civilizing, of training resources or identifying if they're non-human or non-living resources as ownership. And so domestication entails that you possess the raison d'être, so the reason for existence of that resource that you identify as your resource.
And in the book, you point out, for instance, that one application of this would be in terms of non-human animals as, like, they are viewed as food sources, or trees are viewed as lumber. They're what John Zerzan would say is, like, reification. They're reified. They're turned into things that are possessed, or their purpose is, as you say, their, yeah, raison d'être. Is that right?
Yeah.
Excellent. I don't speak French. But yeah, is to serve a certain need for human beings. I think it was really interesting the way that you talked about food chains and in some of the earlier essays, and in particular, the conversation, bringing it back to this classroom setting that I imagine you witnessed, where different children were shown pictures of zebras. And can you go through that, what that was?
Yes, absolutely. That was a project here in Montreal from UNICEF. It was a project with schools and different libraries. There were contests, and it was called Diversity Project. And so the group would go. The workshop basically entailed to have kids from different ages. There were different groups, and I observed them to ask. Basically, that particular example was in terms of the children were asked to draw something from their lives or neighborhoods, something they experienced. And then the animators were going to use those drawings to kind of point to the importance of diversity. And yes, that was really heartbreaking in the sense that there was one child who kind of didn't refuse, but he expressed that diversity in a wild sense, which is exactly like the whole point and how he was domesticated. Basically, the children would, like, some would draw whatever, you know, a rabbit or a dog or a tree, and the animator would go, okay, Susan, what is a dog for? Or a dog is to guard. Nice. What is the tree for? Oh, the tree is to give us shade or air or something, you know? And then this one boy drew like this really intricate painting. And so there was like a lion, a zebra, you know, like a sun, the sun was shining. And the animator asks him, oh, so Zeki, what did you draw? And he's like, well, this is a zebra, this is a lion, this is like, okay, and why do they exist? So here the question already frames an expectation from the children that nothing should exist for their own selves. They should exist for a reason, and that reason is identified by the human beings. And so we, the animators, the carriers of knowledge of that reason, shall now guide you to understand and unlock that reason for existence. So this is like the underlying message in the whole exercise. And so she asks, what do zebras exist for? And he said, well, they're pretty and they run fast. And the animator explains, no. She's like, well, you know, all the other kids answered correctly. No, Zeki, you know, the zebras exist for the lions to be eaten, you know. And here is the domestication through representation, which is a big problem in itself. You know, that's like, you know, John Zerzan's critique of symbolic culture and representation. It's easy when you take that image and you put that image in a category, an epistemological category of how we construct knowledge, how we know the world, without actually going and interacting with the zebra and seeing, why does the zebra exist? Does the zebra see that she exists for the lion? Does the lion think every single zebra exists for its own satiation? No, the lions don't, like, I grew up in Africa, I've been around animals, I've been in the savanna, and for the most part, the gazelles, the zebras, they wander around, the lions sleep, and everybody knows at what point would the lioness go hunting, and there's a mobilization, and so everyone lives, everyone runs, everyone enjoys their lives, and everyone cooperates to protect each other. And when the lioness catches someone, it's usually someone old or sick, and still the lioness will never catch all the zebras, will never catch all the old or weak zebras. A lot of them will die of old age. So there is that wild reason for existence just for their own pleasure of existence that we cannot and should not meddle with and try to appropriate and possess. And this is what people find it really difficult, domesticated or civilized people. Like usually the first thing, and it's usually men actually, a white man in my talks, when I talk about this circle of predation that is a humanist invention in order to justify our own predatory culture and civilization. So the first thing is usually, oh, wolves hunt. Oh, lions eat. So I'm like, well, lions don't hunt all the time, everyone. And you are not a lion. You are not a wolf. So that is not a logical analogy even to make, a reasonable analogy. So that's basically...
You've been listening to the first portion of an interview with Leila Abdel-Rahim on her recent book, Wild Children, Domesticated Dreams, Civilization and the Birth of Education. Wild Children was published last year by Fernwood. More information on the book can be found at fernwoodpublishing.ca. The remaining 1 hour of the conversation will be featured on our next episode of The Final Straw. Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Berso Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF out of Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP out of Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found at thefinalstrawradio.noblog.org. You can podcast the show from radio4all.net. Sobre vos, aos homens solentes.